Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, so last night, let's talk Monday Night Football. Last night was a pretty horrible night for the Gruden family. Jay Gruden got his ass kicked on national television. John Gruden played a part in that. Because in case anybody forgot, John Gruden was the guy who traded Khalil Mack. And in case anybody forgot, Khalil Mack is really good at football. Because Khalil Mack does things like this.
Second and eight. Here's Keenum in trouble. And down he goes.
Ball. Oh.
Ball is out and he covers it up. It's Khalil Mack on the sack of Case Keenum.
Uh-oh. Bears Radio. Khalil Mack does things like that. And Khalil Mack does things like this.
In the gun is Case Keenum. Thompson in the backfield. Belt high long snap. Drops back. He's hit the ball jarred free. It's bouncing. It's rolling. It's loose. And who's got the ball? It's Chicago.
Westwood won on that call. Two sacks. Two forced fumbles. And he had another sack and fumble called back because of a penalty. That would have been three sacks and three forced fumbles. That's an entire season for a lot of guys. And he did it in one game. Better yet, Khalil Mack did that in the first half. Jay Gruden had to be watching that and wondering what the hell his brother John Gruden was thinking when he traded that guy. Like, what's up with you, brother? Especially since the guy that he traded did not ask for a trade, nor was he looking to leave.
Khalil Mack didn't want to play here.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he did, John. And I'm pretty sure Jay was pumped that John was personally responsible for nearly getting Jay fired on the spot last night. Thanks, bro!
Thanks, John.
Yeah! However, it wouldn't be fair to put this all on the Gruden bros. I mean, yeah, it was a terrible look for anybody and everybody with the last name Gruden. But that was a terrible night for Washington on the whole. Actually, it would be a terrible night for any other team. But for Washington, it was just a night. It's what they're used to. It's who they are. It's what they do. It's where they live. It's been like that for a long time. It probably will always be like that. I mean, it's not exactly a well-kept secret that the Redskins are absolute garbage on Monday night. Last night's 31-15 loss meant they have dropped seven straight home Monday night games. That is the second longest home losing streak on Monday night. So, Washington has the second longest home losing streak on Monday night. I know what you're thinking. Man, who's got the longest? They must be horrible. The answer is Washington. They have this current seven-game streak, and they've got a 10-game streak that came before it. They're 1-17 at home on Monday night. The hell is the league doing letting the Redskins anywhere near Monday night with a record like that? Actually, I've got a better question. The hell is the league doing letting the Redskins near any game Monday, Sunday, Thursday, etc.? I mean, at this point, I've got to ask, what is the point? What are they doing? I mean, seriously, what are they doing right now? Miami takes all this heat for tanking, and they should. But Washington is this bad, and they're not even tanking. They're trying. And they were still getting hammered 28-3 in the first half at home on Monday night. In fact, I could actually argue that while the Dolphins might be the worst NFL team ever, the Redskins situation might be even worse. While it guarantees nothing, the Dolphins at least have a bleep ton of picks. What do the Redskins have? Like Scary Terry and a bunch of garbage.
Garbage.
This is who Washington is. This is what they are as a franchise. And this is what they have been for a long time. Garbage.
Garbage.
From top to bottom. We're in the sixth year of Jay Gruden's run. He's been to the playoffs once. Any other serious organization with a serious fan base would see something like that and make a move a long time ago. Washington, though, just acts like it's not even happening. They pretend it's not happening, and they simply hope that nobody notices, except people are. Attendance is falling. Interest is practically non-existent, and yet nothing changes. At this point, I'm not sure what's worse, the organization and how it runs, or the apathy and the fact that nobody seems to give a damn. Like, I know the fans are over it because they're not showing up. The front office doesn't really seem to mind either because they're not doing anything to fix it. It doesn't really seem to bother anybody, does it? Except for defensive end Jonathan Allen, who said after the game that the team has got talent, but what does talent really matter?
You can look at the worst team in the NFL. Every team has talent. That means absolutely you don't win games with talent. Simple as that. There ain't no magic sauce to get this thing turned around and doing the little things right. You're not going to support us now, which you shouldn't, because we're playing like mother. I don't know what you want me to tell. So don't support us now, don't support us later. We going to circle the wagons in this motherfucker. We going to get right. Believe that.
Well, man, Jonathan, I like the attitude. I do. I like that you're owning it. I like the attitude. I just wish that I could believe in it. Because getting bleep right in Washington is not just about the players. It's about everything in that organization. And that organization has got a way of taking pretty good things and making them really bad things. Like, if Thursday Night Football was a team, it would be the Redskins. If the phrase world of suck,
living in a world of suck,
was a team, it would be the Redskins. Like Case Keenum. I mean, nobody's ever going to say Case Keenum is Patrick Mahomes. But Case Keenum is a solid enough quarterback. And he's been pretty solid through the first two games. But then the Washington kicked in. Five turnovers last night, like this one, which was totally and completely amateur hour.
Keenum is under center. Shy of the 15, gets the ball, tries to leap, knock the ball away as he was leaping over the pile. It's loose, it's rolling, and Chicago is recovered. Chicago is recovered. The quarterback on a keeper trying to leap over the pile on a fourth and one with the ball extended with both hands, and it was punched out. And it was punched out and rolled backwards, and Chicago recovered. Keenum's fifth Redskins turnover.
I mean, he was trying to go over the top for first down, but in reality, he was just handing the ball to Chicago. It's a rookie move. It's a high school move. Here, you want this? I don't want it. Here, you take it. I don't need it. That's a rookie move. It's a high school move. Then again, Washington is a rookie organization, a high school organization. Everything about that organization is amateur hour. From the fact that they're god-awful on Monday night to the way they welcome my guy, London Fletcher, to the Ring of Honor by misspelling his name on the scoreboard. London Fletcher. My man goes to four Pro Bowls. He starts 112 straight games for your team. An all-time Redskin great. And you misspell his name on the Jumbotron? How high school of them. FIU's Ronald Berkman and President Madik cannot believe how badly Washington screwed that up.
On behalf of President Madik, I'm glad to welcome you all and to welcome Isaiah Thompson as FIU's basketball coach.
President Madik is like, hey, whoa, leave me the hell out of this, fan smack. That was all Berkman. Listen.
Isaiah Thompson.
When you hire a guy like Isaiah Thomas at a school like that, you're doing it for the name entirely. For the name. So maybe you don't butcher the guy's name.
Isaiah Thompson.
So when you're putting somebody into the Ring of Honor, same thing goes. The name is the only thing that matters. They apparently got it right in the Ring of Honor and yet somehow managed to mangle it on the scoreboard. It's not like Fletcher is some overly complicated name either. It's pretty straightforward. And he was pretty much the last good thing to happen to that organization. But as good as he is, even London Fletcher cannot overcome the Washington-ness of this organization. Remember, Dan Snyder is a guy who Stephen Jones called a, quote, visionary. Let me tell you something. The only visionary I saw in that stadium last night was the dude who got caught on camera stirring the Gatorade with a sleeve of cups. Have you seen this? This guy went into a jug of Gatorade, stirred the entire brew with a sleeve of cups. That was so Washington. Like, you see that and you think, man, that is disgusting. That is disgusting. That's what you think. I see that and I think, Washington. I see that and I think visionary. Other teams might go with a guy who's got a big old paddle or a wooden spoon. Not Washington. They're the only team that would somehow have an employee stirring the bucket with a sleeve of cups. Yo, my man, why not just stick your entire arm in there and give it a spin? Roll up your sleeve, get in there. Or better yet, you know what? Take off your shoe, roll up your pants leg, and get in there and do it with your leg. We were talking to Brandon Tierney. So you see Jones, and he gets that start against Tampa Bay. What did you make of what you saw from him and how electric he was?
Well, you know, I think you even have to go back before the Bucs game here, Jim. He was in studio. He was doing an internship down at the Stock Exchange last summer. He just came in, and he was chopping it up with me and Tiki off air. And his disposition was just naturally calm. So I thought that was a good foreshadow. In hindsight, I don't know that I really thought about it then, to be honest with you. But now as I look back on that first meeting, I'm like, you know what? This kid has the perfect disposition to try to, you know, flourish in New York and step in for a franchise icon because he's got a slow heartbeat. And everybody was crushing the pick, and he just kept a tough chin. He said, okay, you know, I will eventually do what I do, and I will quell those detractors, that loud noise, that negative energy. And then you see him step on the field, you're like, whoa, we could get past page one of the playbook here. This guy's got a little wiggle. There was one play where he actually felt the pressure in the pocket. He didn't waver too far from the pocket, but he took two quick steps to his left and he flung it off his back foot 40 yards on a rope, Jim. And I think that's where people said, wow, this isn't just a cute, you know, a little smart story from Duke. This kid's 6'5", who's 220, who ran an impressive 40, who's got arm talent, who really just looks like he's ready and completely in control. He's immersed in the moment. He just fit. He looked like a third-year player. He didn't look like a rookie. Now, you want to say it's the Bucs? That's fine. That's fair. Still on the road. There was a different energy in that building that day because they retired. They put Rondé in the Ring of Fame at halftime, in the Ring of Honor at halftime. So there was a little more juice maybe than an ordinary Tampa Bay Bucs game would be. It's been a relatively benign there for a better part of a decade, whatever. But Daniel Jones, in one game, Jim, it's amazing, has just silenced every single detractor and every discerning voice. It's amazing.
Brandon Tierney joining us. All right, so we can say that's just the Bucs, but let me put it to you another way.
Mm-hmm.
Do the Giants win that game with Eli Manning at quarterback?
No, there's no way. If they're down 18 points, there's absolutely no chance that they win the game because they just don't have enough in the playbook that, you know, it's just you have to do conventional stuff. You can't roll them out. You can't do misdirections. You can't do, you know, the things that the young modern quarterback can do. So, in fairness to Eli, again, if they're down by a couple of scores, no, he doesn't have the weaponry and he doesn't have the talent to do that by himself. You know, if it's 0-0 from the outset, who knows? The Bucs aren't that good. They seem pretty destined to try to want to give that game away. But I'll tell you this here, Jim. This is an interesting referendum, granted a quick one and an early one, on Pat Shurmur. I don't know if Pat Shurmur could coach, and quite frankly, I don't think anybody in New York believed before this game that he can coach. Think about his three previous seasons, Jim. 2 5-11s, 1 4-12. Two seasons with the Browns, one ugly season with the Giants, and he's sitting here saying, this guy's an offensive genius. This is the most pedestrian, pathetic offense I've ever seen. And then you start to see, oh, wow, this is what it looks like when you could get a little deeper in the playbook. You could do this, and you could do that, and I could mix this, and I could mix that. At least now people don't believe that Pat Shurmur is an unmitigated disaster.
Brandon Tierney joining us on the program once again. So what did you think when Saquon Barkley first suffered that injury? What kind of thoughts did you have?
You know, I'll tell you what, I texted Tiki. Tiki was in the booth for Fox with Rondé. I thought his knee exploded. It obviously is an ankle, and, you know, timetable 4-8, and we know he's a freak, but now we get to see what his if he has supernatural recuperative powers, which he very well might. Jim, I thought his knee exploded. I really did. You know, that's the thing. You take a quarterback at that a running back at that spot in the draft. Yeah, quarterbacks could get hurt as well. I get it. Carson Palmer's knee got blown up. Tom Brady's knee got blown up. Jimmy Garoppolo's knee got blown up. Various draft selections. I get that as well. It's the NFL, and there's big bodies at high rates of speed and ridiculously violent collisions. And bodies get compromised. And while you could kind of protect yourself for a hit and almost kind of roll into it safely, sometimes you get pulled down from behind by somebody who's 240. and there's just no human salvation. So, you know, when you talk about draft equity, a top 10 pick on a running back, that's what you worry about. Look at Gurley with the arthritic condition in his knee. Saquon, narrowly averted disaster. He's such a good kid. He's such a weapon. In a weird way, I said this to Tiki too, Jim. In a weird way, this might be a bit of a silver lining, very much short term, for the development of Daniel Jones. Now that he's not there, you're going to have to really look across the entire football field rather than, hey, in my back pocket, once the pressure comes, boom, let me dump it 2 yards to Saquon and let him make everybody miss. Now it will almost accelerate his development and force him to go through deeper progressions. It, obviously, you want Saquon, but if there's a silver lining, that's the best I could give you.
Brandon Tierney joining us to talk some New York football. Before I let you go, let's talk about the Jets again. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned they jump out to a 16-0 lead on the Bills in week one. It's a big statement against a divisional rival. And then they give up 17 straight and they lose that game. How did that feel in that moment?
I'll tell you, you want the honest answer? I was sitting in my man cave with my 4-year-old son, and I'm saying to myself, why the hell am I subjecting this young man to this team? Well, Jim, why am I doing it to this kid? You know, it happened to me, and I suffered through the decades. I get it. But am I going to really hand the baton to this harmless, you know, innocent little 4-year-old? Do I really need to do this?
Right.
It sucked. I mean, what do you want me to say? You got to modify expectations. You have to know when you have a team, and you have to know when you don't. And listen, I do this for a living. Not that I'm always right, but I obviously have a grip on the league, and I kind of know what's up. And I know when it's a stretch to say the Jets can compete, and I know when it's a stretch to say that it's not a stretch for them to have a representative team. I chronicled before, as soon as we started the interview, the conversation, that there was a positive energy with this team. But I want to point this out. I know you got to run. Well, this is important, though, for the Jets, okay? Adam Gase. Now, I know he looked strung out on drugs with those ridiculous memes at his press conference. It was bizarre. I actually thought, and of course he wasn't, I actually thought I was okay with the hire. I thought for finally the Jets are insulating a young quarterback with a young, innovative offensive mind. But I'll tell you this right now. Adam Gase better change his body language quick, because you get one chance, and you know this, Romy, you get one chance to implement a culture of accountability and positivity and belief. And every time he slumps to that podium and he's looking down, his hat pulled over his eyes like a high school kid who doesn't want to get called on in the back of the class for a biology question, you got to project a little more forcefully, man. I still believe in Adam Gase, and the weapons are coming back. Sam is on the mend. He needs to change the body language. People feel it, and people don't like it, and neither do I.
I agree with you. The body language and the attitude, man, are terrible. And you only get that first chance, that one chance.
Yeah.
If you're trying to create that culture, it seems to me it's not working. One more thought about Darnold. Now,
sure.
The point, the expectation is, Brandon, that he's going to be back for week 5 against Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. He was quoted yesterday as saying, we're going to go on a little run here. It's going to be fun, but it's going to take a lot of work. End of quote. I mean, obviously, you want your starting quarterback to have, well, good body language and a good attitude. But from what you've seen, is there any reason to think they're going to go on a run?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit here. I think when you go macro view, you're obviously a national show. I'm a national show. I think macro fans are like, please, the Jets, whatever. Wake me up when they're relevant. I think when you get a little more micro, to get a little deeper into the weeds, you really do real. And I don't just mean Le'Veon Bell and C.J. Mosley; those are obvious ones. But their starting tight end, who trust me is going to be good, Herndon, suspended the first 4 games of the season. And I almost look at it, I say, wow. So I'm almost, in a way, galvanized. Yeah, they blew the 16-point lead against the Bills, and I'm sitting there saying, man, Darnold missed a couple of throws I really thought he would make this year. But at least now I could say he had mono. So the belief is once he's healthy, he will connect on those throws. The schedule is harsh, man. But if you want to contend, you got to beat some good teams. So they're coming off. They'll get to the bye. You'll get an Eagles team that was very beat up. And if you could start to string together a single win, you know, you got Miami twice, you got the Giants down the road on the schedule, you get the Bills again, obviously, who are pretty good, and Bills Mafia is rolling. Do I think they 0-3 is too tough for this team? But they're not going 2-14. Put this in the bank, Jim. There will be a point this football season where people look at the Jets and say, that's what I thought I would get in September.
He is the host of Tiki and Tierney. It's coming up right here after this show on CBS Sports Radio and CBS Sports Network. Also an NFL analyst on the Other Pregame Show on CBS Sports Network. He is an Emmy Award winner. Valued member of the CBS family, Brandon Tierney. My man, BT, I will see you this weekend in New York.
Love it. Thanks a lot, Romy. Anytime, brother.
We talk some college football right now. So when I mention Mike Gundy, what do you think? The Oklahoma State head football coach is known for a number of things. Like if I were to say to you, Mike Gundy reaction, you'd probably think one of three things, right? Consistent winning at his alma mater. Legendary rants directed at the media. And his famous, glorious beaver paddle mullet. I could sit here all day long and run down the resume of a guy with 9 bowl wins in 14 seasons. I could empty the archive of him just teeing off at reporters who deserve it. Or I could just wax eloquently about his Canadian passport haircut. But I don't need to. You know this guy. You know what he's about. You know he can coach. You know the guy's got a Hall of Fame soundbite locked and loaded at all times. And you know he still rocks the sickest lettuce in all college football, if not all of sport. You know this about Gundy. But some of you may not know and may not be as schooled up on another Oklahoma State icon, the late T. Boone Pickens. I'm sure many of you know him and you know that name. If not, here's a brief refresher. T. Boone Pickens was an extremely wealthy oilman. He died earlier this month at the age of 91. Like Gundy, Pick also went to college in Stillwater. Over the years, Thomas Boone Pickens, you want to talk about a wealthy oilman? He donated a total of $1 billion to OSU. Billion with a B. You know, the kind of jack that gets your name on a few buildings around campus, including the football stadium where the Cowboys play on Saturdays and where Mike Gundy has coached since 05. So I mentioned that Pick passed away earlier this month. 13 days ago, to be exact. One day after his passing, some obscure website called whatthefussnews.com published an article titled T. Boone Pickens leaves Mike Gundy $30 in his will to go to Sports Clips. Now, something as absurd as that, something as absurd as a super famous dying billionaire leaving 30 bucks to a super famous college coach to chop off his Mississippi mud flap. If that were a thing, it would have made the rounds by now. We would know about it. Except it's not. It's like a ridiculous thing. And it's been 13 days since that article was published, and nobody knew about it. Nobody had heard about it. So it's not a thing, right? You would know about it, right? Well, here's what you don't know, or why you don't know. The article was like a really bad attempt at satire, like a total wannabe onion piece with none of the subtleties that make satire satire. And it was published to a website that at last check had 28 Twitter followers. Not 280,000, not 28,000, not 2,800, not 280, 28. So let me give you a part of the article so you can see why this joke never got off the ground. And I'm going to read directly from the article right now. Quote, surprisingly, amongst other specifics in his will, Pickens left $30 to head football coach Mike Gundy to get a GD haircut. Pickens said in his will, I begged him for years to cut that godforsaken mullet off. Maybe now is my dying wish he'll take it more seriously. Gundy replied, gosh, I'm honored that Mr. Pickens would name me in his will, but god dang it, my mullet keeps too much or helps too much in croutin'. Sources say Gundy has been going around Stillwater, drowning his sorrows with a bottle at several local bars, riding mechanical bulls, and desperately searching for a reason to go against Pickens' wishes. So directly from the article, word for word, not at all funny, not amusing, not clever. Again, satire only works if it's believable. Mike Gundy bringing his own bottles to local bars, riding mechanical bulls, is way too try hard to get anybody who matters to bite. Or so you would think. Enter Mark Rosner of the AP. Yes, the AP. The freaking Associated Press. The best of the best. I remember when I was coming up, we all wanted to work for the AP. That was a big, big deal, man. Big deal. When I was in Santa Barbara, every once in a while somebody would bust out and get to the AP, and we were like, damn, big deal. Sincerely. Curators of news, enemies of lies, journalism's finest. So this guy's on a Big 12 conference call with Gundy. And instead of asking Gundy about maybe that tough loss to Texas, the upcoming game against K-State, he decides to ask him about that 13-day-old article that was tweeted out to 28 followers. Check out this exchange.
Was there any truth to those reports that Boone Pickens kind of was joking around and left you a gift card for a haircut?
Don't hurt the real journalism world. It's jackasses like you that cause problems, okay? They shouldn't even let you call in. Do you want to talk football? We'll talk football. If you want to be out there and talk idiotic social media, then you need to go do something with a college kid.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
M.R. Gundy, if you need him. Michael Ray Gundy, if you need him. And honestly, I think we all do. Telling an AP journo to not hurt the real journalism world is, in the words of Mike Leach, utterly outstanding. You gotta love when a college coach is a better steward to journalism than an accredited AP journo. To call him a jackass on a recorded call with multiple other journos on it, man, that is too much. I think my favorite part, though, is after he swiftly rips this dude's cred to shreds, the journo has no choice but to thank him for it and hang up, because it was that good and that appropriate of a verbal ass-whipping. And the guy deserved it. And then after that, after Jay thanks Gundy for it, Gundy hits him with a, you bet.
Was there any truth to those reports that Boone Pickens kind of was joking around and left you a gift card for a haircut?
Don't hurt the real journalism world. It's jackasses like you that cause problems, okay? They shouldn't even let you call in. Do you want to talk football? We'll talk football. If you want to be out there and talk idiotic social media, then you need to go do something with a college kid.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
You bet. You bet. Like, come on back anytime you want. I'll be happy to tell you how bad you're hurting the journalism world once again and why you're a jackass and why you should not be allowed to make a phone call to this conference call. Anytime. My pleasure. No problem. Sure thing. Happy to do it. You bet.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Listen, this is not where I live. I think if you listen to the show, you know that I'm not here to call out my own kind. I'm not here to put media members on blast. I think you learned that about me a long time ago. Have you noticed that? I never talk about other shows. I don't talk about other hosts because I'm here to talk sports and maybe some pop culture and things like that. It's too easy to talk about the other shows and other people. But come on. I mean, the article this dude referenced was written nearly 2 weeks ago and tweeted out to 28 people and not picked up by anybody, and included a part where sources told the unnamed author that Gundy was getting drunk and riding mechanical bulls while mulling the decision about whether or not to take a $30 gift card from a famous dead billionaire. So if you're going to ask that same coach if there's any truth to that, you're going to get owned by Gundy and called a jackass. Because as Gundy said, you're not helping the, quote, real journalism world. You're hurting it. And you shouldn't be doing that on Big 12 teleconference calls, Rosner.
Don't hurt the real journalism world. It's jackasses like you that cause problems, okay? They shouldn't even let you call in.
Anthony Walker makes his jungle debut. Anthony, good to have you on. How are you?
I appreciate you guys having me on. How you guys doing?
Good. Good to have you. You know, guys always talk about how hard it is to win in the NFL, so that's a given. Every win in that league is special, but how good did it feel to win the home opener on Sunday and to do it against a good Falcons team?
Yeah, I think, I think Peyton Manning talked to us during training camp and was like, don't never get tired of winning. You know, I don't care how good you are, how good, you know, you think your team is, you know, you can't take winning for granted, because it's so hard to win in this league. And I tell everybody, my family, they're like, man, I want to come to a good game. I'm like, dude, you can come to every game. Every game is going to be decided by one score or less 90% of the time, you know. So I think, you know, going against this opponent that we just, you know, faced Atlanta, I mean, so many weapons on offense, a great quarterback, you know, weapons on defense and everything like that, for us to come out and, you know, play in front of the home crowd for the first time and get that win, you know, is definitely great.
Anthony Walker joining us. Now, you had an absolutely huge game. It seemed like you were everywhere. What was your mindset going into that game?
I just wanted to do my role on the defense. I know I had, the move to Darius Leonard position at will, knowing he'd be out. I just wanted to make as many plays as I could. You know, I know Darius' whole mindset is he doesn't have 15 tackles a game, then he played bad. So, obviously, I played bad in his eyes. And I told him I'll play better next week for him. So if he's not out there with us.
Yeah, that's really something. Like, it should come as no surprise whatsoever based on what you did last year and the fact that you and Darius Leonard were the league's leading tackle tandem. But if you go back to your rookie year, you had to fight through some injuries and you didn't get rolling the way you would have liked. So when you look back on that rookie year, what kind of thoughts do you have? And what was it like to deal with those challenges?
Yeah, I was just actually talking to one of our rookies about it. I said my rookie year, I basically took it as my redshirt year of college. I was hurt and everything like that, but I used it to, you know, kind of get my body in the physical shape that I needed it to be in, you know, to be an NFL player. I also just learned the ins and outs of the game. I watched the guys that were in front of me, you know, like John Bostic, Antonio Morris, and all those guys. I watched those guys prepare and everything like that, learn from them, and then just kind of try to apply it to my routine and everything like that. So I think it helped me more than anything. You know, it definitely put everything in a perspective of, you know, me being hurt. You know, you can't take the game for granted and everything like that. But I could also use it as a positive to understand, you know, what it means to be a pro.
We're talking to Anthony Walker. Now, you mentioned that Darius Leonard was hurt. How would you describe, when he's out there and the success you guys have had playing together, how would you describe the chemistry between you and Leonard on the field?
Yeah, I mean, I think we play really well off of each other. You know, I know Darius is always going to be, you know, he's going to have my back if I go and try to take a risk, and I'm going to have his if he does the same thing. So I think we play really well off of each other, number one. But I think that's more so based on the relationship we have off the field. And he's probably at my house waiting for me right now. But that's just we just always hanging around each other outside of football. And when you build that relationship, that makes the on-field relationship even much better.
We're talking to Anthony Walker, and we're talking Colts football. So when Andrew Luck announced his retirement, there was a story that you told Jacoby Brissett, quote, "Dude, 100%. Let's go. We're with you," end quote. So what had you seen from him in the past that gave you that kind of confidence in him?
Yeah, also my rookie year, because I didn't play, I got a chance to sit back and watch the offense a little bit more as well. So I saw what Jacoby brought to the table. I saw, again, my dad was an offensive coordinator, quarterback coach when I was growing up in high school. So I kind of have, like, you know, what a good quarterback is and, how they look, you know, and just their demeanor. And when I was watching Jacoby, I just saw how, you know, he was so confident, even keeled, you know, no matter what the situation was, going good or bad. And then I saw this year, we have weapons. You know, we have guys that can go out there and really, you know, when they have the ball in their hand, they're very dangerous. And we have the offensive line, we have the running game and everything like that. So, I was really confident because, you know, the guys around Jacoby more so than, you know, just Jacoby. I know he's going to be great, but I know his mindset is, man, if I get the ball into my playmaker's hands, you know, they're going to make me look good. So, yeah, I was really, you know, really, really confident in him because I know, you know, the type of person he is, the way he prepares as a, you know, quarterback and everything like that, but also the weapons that we have around him.
Colts linebacker Anthony Walker is joining us. You know, when you talk about guys that you had confidence in and a guy whose back you also had, how about Adam Vinatieri? All week long, you were telling everybody, this guy's going to bounce back. He's going to be fine. And sure enough, he was 2 for 2 on field goals, perfect on extra points. Man, how good did it feel to see him show up like that?
Yeah, I mean, he definitely made me look like a smart man.
Yep,
so,
right?
But no, I mean, again, when you're talking about the GOAT, you know, at the position, you know, many who's kicked so many game winners, Super Bowl winners, whatever it is, playoff winners, you know, you talk about, you know, that guy right there, you know, take everything else out of it. If anybody can get, you know, get out of, you know, whatever you want to call it, it's him. So I knew that, you know, he'd just go back to the drawing board, go back to preparing, you know, the same way he did every time. And, you know, he's going to execute when his time was called again. So, again, we're all human. You know, I guess Vinny just looks at it as a superhuman. because of all the greatness that he's displayed over the years. But, again, you know, I wasn't surprised that he did what he did on Sunday, and I was very, very happy for him because, again, you know, at you know the game, this the fans and everything like that, they hate you at one moment, they love you at one moment. But, you know, with him, he never wavered. He kept his head down, stayed focused, and, you know, that's what I expected from him, though.
You know, you mentioned your dad, and the Colts did a really cool video where you went back home to South Florida. What was life like for you growing up there?
Yeah, you know, it was really, you know, my dad was huge on academics, number one. So I think that was kind of where my, you know, my my foundation was built, you know, very strong academic background. And then, you know, football, athletics period came after that. But, you know, again, you know, South Florida, you know, that's all we really pretty much know how to do is play football. You know, that's if there's one thing. So, again, I had a lot, I played with a lot of, you know, great, talented guys, you know, growing up. You know, that guys that weren't able to make it to the NFL that I thought, you know, man, there's no way he's not going to play in the NFL. So I was able to play against a lot of elite talent very, very early, and I think that kind of helped me a lot. Yeah, and then going to Northwestern from there, I thought, you know, that was, you know, pretty much my dad was big on, again, academics and everything like that. I was really huge on going to Stanford or Duke. Wasn't able to get a scholarship offer from those two, and ended up going to Northwestern, and I think it worked out pretty well.
That's amazing, really. Three amazing institutions. Like, really quickly, you tell a story about how you ran track when you were roughly 10 or 11, and your dad came up with the idea that you do these track workouts in the morning, then you go to school, then you do your regular track practice in the afternoon.
Yeah.
What do you remember about those sessions?
Yeah, I hated it, actually. No, that was probably one of the, you know, if me and my dad ever got in an argument, which we rarely ever did, but if we did, it was definitely over track because he knew from my friends did football and basketball, and he knew I wanted to play basketball, so he let me play my first year, but he said I had to do track as well. So he let me see, like, you know, how hard that would be. So, and then both of those are in the same season. So he was like, all right, I just want you to focus on track. You know, I'm listening to my dad. You know, I know my dad knows best. And, you know, I definitely think track did build a great foundation for me as far as form running and, you know, building, you know, stamina and everything like that. And one thing I tell people, difference between track and every other sport is track is more mental than anything. And people can say that about a lot of sports, but track is very, very mental. You know, running the 400, you know, all that stuff. It's very, very tough, but I think that, I mean, I really hated track growing up. I really did, but I do think it was definitely huge for me and my success in football today because, you know, it definitely helped me a lot.
He is a linebacker for the Colts, coming off a huge game in that win over Atlanta. As I mentioned, 14 tackles, 2 tackles for a loss, and you've got Indianapolis hosting Oakland Sunday, 1 p.m. Eastern. It's on CBS. The Colts are 2-1. Anthony Walker, my guest. My man, you crushed that. Great to have you on, Anthony. Thank you very much. Let's do it again.
I appreciate you guys having me on. Whenever you're ready, I'm ready.
Eagle fan really is something else. Truly. No one like him. There have been some legendary Eagle fans throughout the years. Now, this is not going to be a take where I pile on Eagle fan or I bring up the fact that Eagle fans booed Santa Claus and they cheered while Michael Irvin lay motionless on the turf. I mean, they don't know if this guy's paralyzed. Well, they don't know if this guy's dead, but they were cheering. They weren't going to wait to find out. Look, I know, Philly fans, those incidents were a long, long time ago, and people who are not from Philly could never understand, much less understand why you were booing Santa. Now, you're right about that. Nobody understands why you were booing Santa, unless you were trying to make him a better Santa. You know, like when you were booing one of the greatest third basemen ever, Mike Schmidt. Because you were trying to make him better. That's always been your reason for booing Mike Schmidt. We're just trying to make him better, Rome. You don't get it. You're not from Philly. Nobody gets it. I know. Look, I'm not here to crack on Philly fan. In fact, I'm here to celebrate Philly fan. I'm here to celebrate you, Philly fan. Because in the last few years alone, you have given the world so many amazing moments. Like when the local news found Bernard English in 2015 after the Eagles beat the Saints.
When Muhammad Ali was down, did you count him out? When Jiminy Cricket was down, did you count him out? This is the comeback, Doug. 2-3. Did you see DeMarco Murray? This is the game, Doug. Woo!
Man, my man losing his mind and going all WWE after watching Sam Bradford and DeMarco Murray beat the Saints en route to a 7-9 season, which ultimately cost Chip Kelly his gig. But try telling that to Bernard. How awesome was that? He's laying it on the line and nearly blowing out his vocal cords, celebrating DeMarco Murray and Jiminy Cricket. And that's not all. It's not a one-off, because there was the Super Bowl season that saw fans literally eating horse crap. That's a dude eating horse crap. And you're not a fan unless you're willing to go there. Plus, how about that time the city needed to apply grease to light poles so that nobody would climb them and get hit in the head with tomahawked Grey Goose bottles?
Oh, I got that out of video.
It's a good thing you did, bro. Literally, some dude celebrating the win by climbing a light pole, and somebody hit him with a tomahawk bottle of Grey Goose. Crowned him. Only thing better than that happening was them going way out of their way to prevent it from happening again. So how do you keep people from climbing light poles? It's impossible, right? Unless you hit them with Crisco, and then they can't get up. So there we were, and this weekend comes around. An Eagle fan caught on TV Sunday, losing his mind as the broadcast goes to commercial break with Philadelphia trailing Detroit 27-17.
They're not happy. Get after it.
This dude's losing his mind. But that was not just some random lunatic screaming, "What the bleep are you looking at?" According to reports, that was the dean of admissions at Penn. It's an amazing moment. The dean of admissions in one of the most prestigious schools in America going full Philly fan on national TV. But even that was not the most impressive Eagle fan moment of the weekend. That honor goes to this hero who was at a fire and described the scene.
I seen a guy hanging out the window, you know, screaming that his kids was in there and things like that. So I ran to the back door, see if it was open, and it was. I ran upstairs, and then I was greeted with smoke. I ran back downstairs. By that time, the ladder truck was pulling up. And ironically, one of my old coworkers took the ladder off the truck, raised it up, and was assisting people down. My man just started throwing babies out the window. Wow. We was catching them, unlike Aguilar.
All right, so you probably have seen this, or maybe if you haven't, I want to make really certain that you understand what that guy just did. Let me repeat that last part. Quote, "We was catching them, unlike Aguilar."
Unlike Aguilar.
This is such an amazing moment. Think about the focus and the presence of mind. Not to catch babies. Not just to do that. Understand, this place is on fire, and they're literally throwing babies out the window, and this guy is catching them. Imagine the presence of mind. Not to catch the babies as they're being thrown out the window of a burning building, but to take a run at Nelson Aguilar after you do it.
Unlike
Again,
Aguilar.
This is a guy who apparently saved children from a burning building, and he's acting like it's no big deal whatsoever. In fact, not only is it not a big deal, it's a smaller deal than Aguilar dropping a pass in the fourth quarter. Catch a child thrown from a burning building, and you're a hero. You're a legend for life. Catch a child thrown from a burning building, and then take a shot at an NFL receiver, and then there are no words for that level of legendary. Everybody always wants to talk about leveling up. You cannot level up beyond that. You know what's cooler than saving a life? Saving a life and clowning an NFL player, apparently. I mean, the pettiness involved, the salt, is unreal. All he was missing was capping it off with, "Hey, Nelson, scoreboard, look up at it. Catch the baby with your hands, not your body. Look the baby into your hands. Wrap it up. Don't start thinking about running with that baby until you've caught the baby and secured it. Look the baby all the way in. Don't alligator arm the baby. You're not going to go over the middle to to catch that baby. But shout out to Nelson Aguilar for handling it in the greatest way possible. He retweets the video with, quote, "Thank you for being a hero in the community. Would like to invite you and your family to the next home game. Twitter, help me out and get me in touch with him," end quote. What an awesome moment. Like, that's how you take a truckload of salt and you turn it into something sweet. Nothing but respect to that fan and to Aguilar. I do hope the reunion happens. And I hope they spend time together on the Jugs machine. Philly fan's the greatest. Philly fan is absolutely the best. Seriously.
We was catching them, unlike Aguilar.
This guy's like so matter of fact. They were throwing babies out of a burning building, and we were catching them. Unlike Aguilar.
We was catching them, unlike Aguilar.
Outfielder Johnny Davis is my guest. Johnny, it's good to have you on. How are you?
I'm good, you?
Good, good. Listen, you've got an amazing story, as I mentioned, and it's something I want to get into in a moment because I think people would be really moved and inspired by it. But before I get there, given everything you've been through, what's it like to be in the majors and come into the ballpark every night with a team that's battling for a postseason spot in late September?
Oh, man, it's a dream come true. It's nothing like it. Just come here and prepare, get ready to go out there and fight for a playoff spot.
All right, so when we talk about your story, if we were to go all the way back, you grew up in Compton. What was life like for you growing up?
I don't know, different, I guess. Especially speaking to other baseball players, you realize how different it is, life that I went through at a young age and things I've seen that I shouldn't have seen and just day-to-day stuff that I went through.
Johnny Davis, my guest, you know, without belaboring it, the fact is you and your mom and your two brothers lived in and out of homeless shelters, and there were times when there just was not even enough to eat. As you said, quote, "If we were lucky, we got ramen noodles. It was cheap. You could get 10 packs for a dollar," end quote. I mean, it sounds like a really, really terrible thing in a really challenging time. What was that period of your life like?
It was tough, man, growing up like that, because, like I mentioned to another guy that interviewed me and told him, like, when you're that young, you don't really, like, even when you're poor, you don't really know how poor you are because you're just a kid having fun. But we were at a stage where I was young and I knew, like, I knew it wasn't all good. I knew I didn't know where the next meal was coming from and things like that. Going in and out of shelters, I knew that wasn't, like, normal for normal kids.
Talking to Johnny Davis, not at all, right? And then you start to play baseball, but even your starting baseball was not normal either. Like, the story goes, you were playing baseball one summer as a punishment, and he said, "Mom, please don't make me play baseball. I'll be good, I promise." So what did you think of baseball when you first started playing?
I don't know, man. I just didn't like it. I wasn't really in it. Like, when I was that young, I wasn't really into sports at all, really. I was into playing outside with my friends, but I wasn't really into – I didn't like baseball. I don't know. It was different, especially because when you're younger, not that many kids are good, so not that many kids can hit the ball to the outfield and just things like that. So it was kind of boring for me. And then so I never played. I told my mom I'd be good and didn't want to go back to the park and play baseball no more and didn't play anymore. Excuse me. Didn't play anymore until I got in college. And the rest of history.
Yeah, I want to get to that. I mean, what you just said is amazing, right? Like, I don't like playing baseball. Don't make me play baseball. And you didn't play again until you got to college. But in the interim, a local legend saw you playing, Gerald Pickens. For those who don't know, who is Gerald Pickens and what does he mean to you?
Gerald Pickens, he's a coach. He's a coach that got a lot of people drafted out of Compton, man. A lot of people played under G. Coach G, and man, he was the inspiration of my life. He, like, even when I wasn't playing baseball, he was my mentor and helped me out with things. Man, he done bought me meals. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, G was big time in my life and big time in a lot of other kids' lives from Compton. And he was trying to convince me to play baseball that whole time. I should have listened to him earlier.
Rays outfielder Johnny Davis joining us. So also the story goes, your younger brother Tyree was playing, and one day you took him to a workout in front of scouts. They were blown away by his speed, but he said, "Man, that's nothing. You should see my brother." Legend has it that you ran a 60-yard dash that day in 5.9 in jeans, 5.9 seconds. What do you remember about that? Is that how that went?
It's kind of how it went, but everybody keeps saying 5.9. It was 6 flat. They giving me that extra little millisecond, but it was 6 flat. But yeah, my little brother, they asked him about his brother, and he was like, "Yeah, I got a brother that's faster than me," and they couldn't believe it. And then they asked me to run, and I ran and ran 6 flat.
You run 6 flat, but like as you point out, like you transferred to high school in Lawndale. You didn't play organized baseball though until you went to West Los Angeles College, and then you tear it up. You hit .336. You had 22 stolen bases. I mean, and dude, is that true? Did you just literally show up in college and start playing baseball? How do you explain having that kind of success without even having played till you got to that level?
I'm a competitor, man. Like, I'm a fast learner. And most of the things that I know how to do now today, I taught myself. So. I taught myself how to do a lot of different things. I taught myself how to play the drums. I taught myself how to ride dirt bikes, motorcycles, and all types of things. So when I looked at baseball, I just looked at it as a challenge that I can teach myself how to do it. And I showed up, and the coach saw that I was an athlete, told me. He was like, "You're in there starting day one." And he threw me out there, kept running me out there, and I ended up doing well.
Dude, like, so when you taught yourself how to play the drums, did you have musical influences? Like, did you throw on the cans, and were you listening to people to teach yourself how to play drums? Did you have influences?
I was in church. I grew up in a church, and it was my our rule at church was you either sing in the choir or you learn how to play an instrument. I taught myself how to play the drums.
Johnny Davis is joining us. That's incredible. So the Brewers draft you. After that season in college, at that point, what were you thinking about your baseball future?
I was thinking just to make it to the big leagues as quickly as I can. That's why I even played in college, because scout told me not to play in college. He was like, "We'll just draft you." And I was like, I want to learn how to play first. I don't want to just show up to pro ball with no experience and be learning on the fly. So I learned a little bit in college, and throughout the minors, I learned every day. I was picking everybody's brain that I could, learning as much as I could.
But it's pretty amazing that somebody like that told you that and said, "This is the way to get there." And you said, no, I'm not in that kind of hurry. I want to learn. I want to be ready when I do get there. And then in your first full season in the minors, you steal 32 more bases, but you blew out your ACL. So at that point, what was it like to put in all that work, get drafted, be on your way, but then suffer an injury like that so early in your career?
Man, it was a blessing and a curse. Like it was like a blessing in disguise, because I got hurt, and I was like sitting there moping around, pissed, because I know I'm older and haven't played that much baseball and I need the reps. But I sat back and learned a lot throughout my rehab process. That whole year, I just sat back and learned the game. I studied it big time, and I've been night and day the baseball player that I am now that I was before the injury. I'm a totally different player, and I'm way better.
Johnny Davis joining us. I'm blown away by the story, because there's so many twists and turns in this. Like, then, you're better, right? You learn about yourself and about the game, and you come back. And then again, you're tearing it up on the base pass. You're a nightmare there. But by the time we get to the start of even last season, you requested your release from the Brewers. Why was that, and what was your plan at that point?
Well, the it wasn't no room for me. I wasn't playing with the Brewers, and I needed to play, and they knew I needed to play. They had made some moves. They had got some guys, and it was a trickle effect. Some guys that came down from the big leagues and was taking up spots in Triple A, that spots that I deserved to play in. But it wasn't much room, and it's business. So we went to Mexico to keep playing because I needed to play, and I got out there and played every day. They had a spot for me to play every day, and I went there and showed out.
Like, it seems to me two things talking to you seem pretty clear to me. Number one, you're your own man. You're going to make your own decisions. And number two, you just want to play. You just want to play, and you want to get better. But Pickens did tell USA Today he thought it was a mistake at the time for you to go to Mexico. Your agent apparently did not love that move either. What made you feel like that was the right place for you?
I don't know, man. I just feel like my speed's undeniable. Like, if somebody's going to hear that it's a fast guy in Mexico tearing it up, That's how I look at it, because it ain't too many people that can run like me in the game of baseball. So I felt like it didn't matter where I played, as long as I played, somebody will see.
Well, that's what happened, right? You go there, you hit 300, and you steal 54 more bases. And then late August, the Rays were looking for another outfielder, especially one that could run. And after they scouted you, they signed you, they brought you into their minor league system. What was it like for you when that happened, and how'd you approach those games?
I approached, like they told me, you're going to come here, we're going to evaluate you. We're going to evaluate you on stealing bags. We want you to steal some bases, and you're going to get in there. They're going to put me in as, like, base-stealing situations. And the manager's like, everybody's going to know you're stealing. I'm telling the other manager, like, telling the catcher, everybody's going to know, and you got to steal a bag. And that's what we did, and I stole the bases, and now I'm here.
All right, so a couple of thoughts before I let you go, because it is a great story. The story goes also, you're in your hotel room playing Call of Duty. What happened then after that? What happened next?
I got a phone call from Brady, AAA manager, and I like get off the phone real quick, and I tell my homeboys, like, hold on, because they're in the microphone. I'm talking to them through the game, and I tell them, hold on, like, but I tell them, like, panicking, like, really fast, like, hold on, and I can hear them talking through the game, and they're talking while I'm on the phone with Brady, and they're like, hey, I think Johnny's getting called up, like, they're freaking out because of the way I got off the phone. And, Brady eventually told me, and after he told me that I was getting called up, I got back on the microphone and told my homeboys, and they were all happy for me, screaming, and I was screaming at the top of my lungs in the hotel room, then called a bunch of texts and called a bunch of people back home. It was a great night,
maybe only better 13 days later. You make your debut against the Rangers, you're a pinch runner, and then on September 13th, you're playing the Angels in Anaheim. You get your first plate appearance as a big leaguer. You hit a triple in the first at bat. After the game, your teammates put you in a laundry cart and showered you with beer, soap, aftershave, and more. What was that whole night like?
Bro, it was unreal, man. That night was special. I'll never forget that night, especially when after leaving the field and going back home and seeing all my friends at the house and chilling and just happy for me and celebrating my success. It was a special night. And the beer shower was awesome. My teammates, they were happier than I was. Like, it was just a great feeling.
Hey, Johnny, last thought. A few days after that, you're playing at Dodger Stadium, all right? And again, remember, you didn't really like baseball growing up. You're from Compton. You've been through all these things. Dodger Stadium's Dodger Stadium, man. Chavez Ravine, there's nothing like it. What was it like to be in front of your family and Gerald Pickens and to play at that yard? In fact, the last couple of weeks, what have they been like? Is there any way to put in words what it's been?
There's really no way to put in words, man. I couldn't believe it. Like, it was, I couldn't believe that I was at Dodger Stadium, like, about to play. Like, that blew my mind, like, especially because, like, I've went to Dodger games and seen, like, people playing, and I'm like, dude, I'm going to be one of those people that other people are looking at down here on this field. It was pretty magical. Like, it was, especially to do it in the home, like, I'm the hometown kid. Like, everybody came out to watch me, family, friends, G, my mom, my dad, like, fiance, my son. My son got to see me on Dodger Stadium. Like, I'll never forget that. And he won't never forget it, so. Yeah, it was pretty dope.
And that is pretty dope. This is why I started the interview by saying this is an amazing story. Johnny Davis is my guest. Dude, I appreciate that so much. I appreciate that you took the time to lay that out, because that is an amazing journey, and I think there's going to be a lot of people who hear that and get a lot from that and see a lot of inspiration in that. The Rays, and on top of all that, I mean, just if you had got to the major leagues, that'd be one thing, but you're right there in the hunt. They're in the second wild card spot, and they're at it again tonight. Johnny, I appreciate you. Thanks for sharing your story. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Let's go to Salt Lake City quickly before I take a break. Spencer in Salt Lake. Good to have you, Spencer. How are you?
Hey, Rob. Thanks for the time, buddy. Hey, I had the privilege of taking the first swing through the jungle about a week or so ago, and I was definitely nervous and started feeling the heat, but I was able to avoid the flame out, dismount, and stick the landing. And a bunch of my Salt Lake City friends hit me up and were picking me up for rep in Salt Lake City. So who knows, maybe we can turn no take lake back into weak take lake, and one day even mediocre take lake. But speaking of my first call, I mentioned getting some karma for the Redskins, and I missed a few days of the show, but I'm guessing that didn't happen. Just a hunch with what the terribly typical laydown last night. And I would say I'm surprised and angry, but you pretty much nailed it, dude. It is just another day at the office for these guys. So, you know, the team takes on the persona of the coach. Basically, their persona is that of a two-day-old wet smash birthday cake that sat in the garbage can upside down on a wet plate of mixed coffee grounds. I mean, they're just so soft. They've just quit. It's ridiculous. Side note, Jay, those glasses that you started wearing, they're not going to make you look smarter or save your job. And, you know, their defensive coordinator, Greg McCloskey, thinks a blitz is basically an everyman's beer from Milwaukee. It's just a mess, dude. The stadium is just filled with the opposing fans, and there's just more penalties than a freaking stop-and-go herky-jerky call from Flamian. And, you know, announcers are talking about bright spots for the future before halftime. It's such a mess. I would say that, you know, I wish I knew how this team could catch a break, but I do know because basically the owner and the GM are like classic 80s movie villains. I mean, they charge people to pick up tickets at will call. They get busted for selling expired beer from the World
Cup. That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
Now, Spencer, if it were up to me, I would not have hammered you the way Alvin did. I think Alvin is projecting. I think Alvin did not appreciate the way I started off the hour by saying, you're on, dude. One person living in Copyright Hills. Rich. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Thanks for taking my call, man, Smack. It's an honor. It's a beautiful day in the jungle. You know why? It's Bills Patriots week once again. One of the 2 weeks each season that I really look forward to, just as much as Raider Mike looks forward to another W this season. He might not see it. Christoph Rome, congratulations are in order for Tom Brady on a great career. But it's over this Sunday. He's going to be taken out by Buffalo's defense. The Bills' D are far beyond legit. It is stacked to the hilt, Romy. Jordan Poyer, Micah Hyde, Ed Oliver, Tremaine Edmonds, Tre'Davious White. Brady will know all of these names very intimately come Sunday evening. Why? Because nobody circles up the wagon like the Bills. The score? 24-13. Then the Bills go on to a minimum of 8-0, win the AFC. Why? Because it started early in August, Rome. The Bills believe again. War Boomer Sooner, War Randall the Stalker, and War, I've got a feeling Buffalo's going to the Super Bowl. I've got a feeling Buffalo.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
Hey, Rich, I got a feeling. I got a feeling you're done. Stop selling my merchandise. I'll allow that once, but you can't circle back and try to keep singing that song.
Good night now!